Welcome to the Bardcast. It's Shakespeare, you dick. We are your hosts. I am Lisa Ann Goldsmith.
I am Owen Thompson. I have to say that was the perkiest intro ever by you.
You know, I'm still on a UK high, Owen. Truly.
I know, me too. Although I wish we're back, guys. You probably know that by now. We're back home. I'm in New York and Lisa Ann is in Pittsburgh. And we love our homes, but I still miss the UK.
If I could blink us and all the pets to the UK, I would do it, Owen.
Well, we're here to talk about, actually, you'll be hearing a conversation between us that takes place in the UK shortly.
That's right. We saw Henry V at the Sam Wanamaker, which is the indoor
Theater at.
The Globe, on January 29th, and we recorded our review of it the next day.
That's correct. And so we're going to be dropping these episodes because we have so much to talk about, and we saw so much in London and in Stratford when we were over across the pond. So we will be dropping every week for a while. And I have to say, I was particularly excited. I think I've mentioned it on the pod before to get into the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, which is like the Globe itself being a scholarly reconstruction of what we our best scholarship tells us that Shakespeare's actual Globe Theatre was like. This is meant to be a reconstruction of what the Blackfriars, the indoor theatre, may have been like. And it was fascinating to be inside that theatre.
It was gorgeous. Not particularly comfortable,
No,
but
I suspect that sitting in the stalls would have been more a little more comfortable than sitting up in the flies where we sat.
yeah, I think we're going to have to do that next time. But we sat in the stalls for both shows that we saw back to back in 2 days at the Sam Wanamaker. But anyway, this is our review of the first one, which was Henry V. So enjoy.
Okay, so the second thing that we saw in London was Henry V.
Yes, at the sound, and we should say we are recording the night after we saw it. We're trying to record these things as close to actual seeing performances as possible. So we saw As You Like It 2 nights ago, and we saw Henry V last night at the Wanamaker Playhouse.
That's right, which is the indoor playhouse at the Globe.
Yeah, we're here in January, so the one unfortunate thing about this trip, and it just can't be helped because of the time of year, is we can't obviously see anything on the. Globe stage, but the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. I was actually very excited to get into it. It's the you for our listeners that don't know, Shakespeare's Globe here is the reconstruction of Shakespeare's actual Globe Theater from the 17th century.
And can I tell you that it's the first time that I've seen it and I literally started weeping? I'm doing a lot of weeping here in the
Well, there's a
UK.
lot of them. Listen, I'll tell you what. I saw the Globe first years ago, but I had the exact same response when I
Oh,
when it
good. That
first.
makes me
If
feel
you've if you've if
better.
you're a big Shakespeare nerd like us, and you haven't you know of its existence, but you haven't seen it, there's just something about. I mean, first of all, it's way bigger than you expect it to be.
It's way bigger than I
It's
expected it to be.
really everybody always says the same thing. I mean, it's easy to forget that the Globe Theatre in Shakespeare's day held 3,000 people.
Which was like a third of the
Well,
population
not
or
a third, but I
something.
mean, London, obviously it varies, but London was approximately 200,000 people strong in Shakespeare's time. So 3,000 people is a fair amount of that, right? But the point is, Lisa Ann saw it for the first time last night, and it's always moving. And the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse is an indoor theater that, again, is like is meant to be like sort of like the say the Blackfriars, where Shakespeare's company performed. Okay, so if we heard that, we're in a hotel, and that's the garbage being taken out. So we're keeping it real, people. Anyway, I think those may be the wine bottles that we've consumed.
Oh my God. Oh my God, you guys. We have, listen, a quick aside here. We have eaten and drunk so much in the like 48 hours that we've been
And it's not going to
here.
stop anytime
No,
soon.
it's not going to
Sunday
stop.
roast is real, y'all. But anyway, the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse is a very small theater that's on in the Globe complex. It probably only seats about 500, I'd say.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more than that.
Very intimate and tight.
Yeah.
Like the seats are tight. And we were sitting on, I don't know what the what the terms are for termination. What the fuck?
You're terminated.
You guys, it's morning. We were sitting, where we were sitting was just benches. They're like not seats. So yeah, it really feels like
there's the stalls below, mm-hmm. and then there's two galleries above, and we were sitting on a little bench. Pretty good seats, actually.
Yeah.
Small house. But anyway, it's a very intimate and fascinating space that I've been dying to get into for years, because every time I've been in London in the last 10 years, for some reason, nothing has been in the Wanamaker. So we're making up for it by seeing two in a row.
Because we're seeing Titus Andronicus tonight.
That's right. We saw Henry V last night with our significant others. And tonight we're seeing Titus Andronicus alone, because they've had enough Shakespeare for now.
But so this Henry V we saw, it was a company called A Headline, mm-hmm. I believe, who was playing there. And Oliver Johnstone played Henry V. Now, I have to say, before we start ripping this apart.
Well, yeah.
He was terrific. I thought he was terrific. And I thought he could have been much more terrific had I not had garbage.
That's the rest of our wine bottles.
Had he not been directed the way he did, but we will get to that.
Right, but let me say also, I agree. I thought he was fantastic, and I thought that the acting overall was uniformly excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
We should start by saying, I suppose, that we're still coming down off the high of As You Like It. So
that's a high bar.
It's a very
you guys.
High bar, because it really was as good as we reported.
Although I was very encouraged after the first act, and then not so much after
the second.
Well, that's
what I was going to say. I actually thought for a while, holy shit, this is really good.
Yeah.
They made some interesting choices. The play does not begin, for those of you who are familiar with Henry V, with
O for a Muse of Fire.
You know, one of the most famous openings in all of Shakespeare. Yeah. It's completely cut. So there's the chorus... never shows up as chorus, but some of chorus's lines are still in. But they open the show with a scene with a scene from Henry IV, Part II, where Hal thinks that his father has died and he's taken the crown. And it actually starts with Henry waking up and being horrified that his son has stolen his crown. And then they do the scene that follows. And I have to say, the actress who played Henry IV. What was her name?
Helena Lindberg.
She was
brilliant.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
Just fantastic. And so was the Henry V.
Yeah.
So that scene played like a house of fire.
Yeah.
And then it's a very stripped down, deconstructed production.
And by the way, I didn't mind that. Like, I understood that. It totally, it's almost like when you watch a show on television and they give you a recap.
Oh, no, you know, I didn't mind. Yeah. I didn't mind the way they opened it, and I didn't mind the deconstructed nature of it either. Just in terms in terms of set and costume, very simple.
There basically is no set.
Right. It's basically just a green curtain, a green floor, some green chairs, plastic chairs, and then the curtain opens to the high wall of the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, which was finished in with a kind of a dull mirror finish.
Yeah.
And I'm
like a glazed mirror.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a feature of the playhouse itself.
Well, we'll find that tonight.
That's exactly right, because we'll see if they use it in Titus as well.
Oh, and guys, they light it with candelabras, like actual candelabras. In fact, there are even two candle technicians listed in the playbill.
Right. And they lower and raise the candelabra throughout to different heights during the course of the play. And that was one demerit for me because, unfortunately, being in the gallery, if the candelabra are lower, it gets, it ruins sight lines.
Yeah, you can't see.
And although throughout Act One they raised higher and higher until they were finally out of the way, unfortunately the director brought them back down for the beginning of Act Two, which I thought was unnecessary.
I agree.
What is the director's name? It is, hold on, it's right here. Holly Race Ruffin. Ruffin, I think, or Rowan.
Maybe Ruffin. Rougham for
yes.
Anybody that wants to look her up.
And throughout Act One, I was fully on board.
Yeah.
I thought it was paced very well. I thought it with some of the choices. For instance, one of the choices, spoiler alert for anybody that doesn't know the play, the traitor conspirators, Scroope and the other two,
yeah.
are cut down to just Scroope in this production.
That's right.
And Henry
executes Scroop himself, personally, by strangling him to death.
But I love what you said about that. It's very like Ned Stark from Game of Thrones, because if you call it, you have to do it.
Yeah, I wonder if it was a little Game of Thrones inspired, which is also interesting because I don't know if you know, last year, Kit Harington, Jon Snow,
yes, played Henry
the Fifth at the Donmar Warehouse.
I would have loved to have seen that.
So me too. So anyway, it was very Game of Thronesy in terms of that. And you know, it just had a headlong quality, and I thought the Henry was so interesting, and that the acting in general was excellent. So I was really with it by the end of Act One.
Yeah, me too.
And an interesting end to Act One. The actor playing Bardolph was hanged on stage.
Yes.
But in sort of in a pantomime way, no actual noose or anything like that. And they left the poor motherfucker standing on the chair that he was hanged on, teetering.
Yeah.
And I thought, are they going to leave his ass for the entire intermission? They did not.
I want to say something about that actor, John Furlong. I loved him, and I thought his voice was terrific. And he has scoliosis.
Yes. Yes.
So he is...
I wonder
his body is somewhat disfigured due to his scoliosis.
If he hasn't played Richard, I'm sure.
Oh my God, he should totally play Richard.
Yeah. Anyway, he was terrific, as was everybody.
Yeah,
really.
Truly.
However.
So the second act started.
And it all went to hell. That might be hyperbole.
That although in the second act was a lot of the fight, and Kate Waters was the fight director, and the fights were fantastic.
I agree. I thought the fights throughout were uniformly excellent.
But,
well, for me the problem was throughout the first act. I was wondering, well, okay, what's your take on this? And you know, Henry V is famously malleable in terms of how you want to play it, like. Very famously, the Laurence Olivier film, which I have a deep and abiding love for, and I know it's old and corny, but that was my gateway drug to Shakespeare when I was a kid.
Right,
seeing that
right.
movie was the first thing that turned me on to Shakespeare.
Right.
And, you know, if you see it, I think some of it still holds up, but it is a propaganda piece. And it, I mean, literally a propaganda piece.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, England, yay, yay, let's go to war.
I mean, it was somewhat commissioned by Churchill himself for the war effort. And it's very, very, very jingoistic, and it's very, war is great and England is great, and,
let's kill everybody and get as much land
so
as we can.
It's not nuanced in that regard. You know, the Kenneth Branagh film from years later is a little more nuanced and certainly grittier.
Agreed.
And I always think, and we were talking about this last night afterwards, this is a little dated, but for me, you know, the very first scene after the prologue, the very first scene of Henry V is all those... like the archbishop and the bishop and all the noblemen, like trying to figure, and Henry trying to figure out a way to verify and justify his claim to the throne of France with Salic laws and all of this stuff. And it's so
looking at the genealogy and all
that. It's so convoluted. And it's like, we need a reason to go to war. We've got to find a reason.
Right.
Because we're going to go to war. We just got to find a reason. Right. And all I think of whenever I encounter that scene, I think of Colin Powell at the United Nations with that little vial of poison, fooling everybody into that there was a reason to go to war in Iraq. And, you know, sometimes I think that that might be a way to stage it, although maybe not, because that's out of the zeitgeist now.
Yeah.
But that's what I... But
totally.
The point is, the play is very nuanced in terms of how you read it. And I think it's one of the play's strengths. Like, for instance, we do see Henry as a great... "quote unquote great warrior leader."
That's right, and listeners, do not forget that this Henry is Hal from Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, right? The fuck up who basically says, "Well, when I become king, I'm going to do what I need to do."
Right, and it was interesting to see a little bit of Hal.
I loved that about his performance.
I agree. And the choice was an excellent choice.
Absolutely.
But you know, although Henry can be portrayed as a great leader, it's very nuanced. Like when he goes among his soldiers. And he hears, like, a little more than maybe he wanted to hear about how they feel about dying in a battle.
Well, that's a little bit of bravado, right? But he's not crazy.
Right. And this production, I wondered where they were going in the first act. But then in the second act, honestly, when it was over, I'm still not 100% sure where they were going. But
no, I agree.
Henry was directed to be angrier and angrier and crazier, and choices were made, like executing Scroop. I thought was great.
Yeah,
but then,
because that has to do with honor.
Well, right? And it's also, yeah. And also Scroop does get executed.
Yes.
But in
yes.
this particular production, Henry himself executes the Dauphin.
Which I thought was...
Well, it doesn't happen in the play.
Right. Why?
It, I mean...
Why are they doing that?
Now you're... Like, I didn't mind, for instance, and I never mind when this sort of thing happens, when Pistol says... I can't remember who he's telling off, but at one point he says, a Figo for thee then, in yeah. the text.
Yeah.
And last night he just said, ah, fuck you.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that.
Well, because it's basically the same thing, right?
Right. I mean, it is. Yeah. It's the same thing. And I don't mind textual emendation like that.
Yeah.
But what I do mind, unless you have a real good reason for it, is when you change fundamental things in the play. And having Henry basically murder the Dauphin.
Wait, I mean, why would you do that?
Well, I mean...
What does it prove about that character, right? If anything, it puts Henry, you know, it pulls Henry away from being a great king and a great warrior and makes him an asshole.
Well, I think that's what they were trying to do, right? Well, I think, and he had, you know, he tied it in, he had a tennis ball from the insult from the Dauphin yeah. from earlier, and he tied it in by putting the tennis ball next to the dead body of the Dauphin, blah, blah, blah. But I think what this...
Although I liked the tennis ball thing. Well, sure. That was fun.
But I think what the director's point was, and I so wish there were director's notes in the program to help us here.
Which there are not.
There are not.
Notes from everybody else except yeah. for Holly Race Ruffin.
But I think where she was going was that... No, like, because the king was shown as sort of nice and noble sometimes, but then increasingly he went a little crazy. And I think the point is, war is bad and makes you do crazy, horrible things. And is a whirlpool of sin that sucks everybody down, right? But and okay, granted that's true, but. She had to mess with things in the play in order to do that. Like, for instance, there was no comedy in the play at all,
no.
which was very unfortunate because there are some really funny scenes in that play. And one of those scenes, sort of towards the end, is when Fluellen confronts Pistol and makes him eat his leek and
yes,
all of that.
Yes.
And in this particular production, Fluellen tried to murder Pistol and thought he had.
I know.
And left him for dead there. Yet another strangulation, by the way. So of which there were many, and they have had diminishing return. But you know, that's to me, that's not the play. And then, sadly, the play really devolved by the end.
Well, and let's
the production.
Let's talk about the St. Crispin's Day speech.
Oh yes.
So it started off very sort of intimate, and I was like, oh, okay, let's. Let's see what we're going to do with this here. But then it sort of became...
Well, he started off angry.
Yes, but it was like... But
at
it
was his
like
brother
this,
who wants more people
Yeah,
there.
But it was like this mad... Mad as in crazy, sort of like rambling and not a piece used to get everybody psyched up to do this... battle.
Well, but that's again.
And there were like three people on stage. It's like, I know you only have 10 people in the cast, but can we at least have a group for him to be talking to?
Right. And again, just for those who don't know, this is a very famous speech where Henry exhorts his troops and gets them going. And it's so famous and so inspirational that it's been used at football matches, for heaven's sake.
Yes. Oh my God.
I mean, it's for those of you who know, obviously it's super famous. And if you don't, YouTube it and you'll see it everywhere.
Yeah, this day is called the Feast of St. Crispin.
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest rah-rah speech of all time.
Totally.
And it's not played that way at all here. Now, first of all, I will say it's so famous that it's like a what do you do with it speech, like to be or not to be. You know, I mean, it's like...
Yes, but you still have to give credence to what the text is and what the circumstances are.
Yeah, but this is my problem, right? Because and this is where, like, she was losing me, this director, because I was like, okay, I begin to see where you're going, and it's not entirely clear to me, but as far as I can figure it out, I don't particularly like it.
No.
He did seem angry and kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And certainly not inspirational.
And certainly doesn't lend itself to the fact that he was a great warrior and a great king.
Right. Well, I mean, well, historically, I mean, he was a great warrior. The truth is, he was kind of a war criminal, that guy. And that was now that
there's plenty of people that might consider that a good king.
Well, he was certainly a successful king in terms of, if he hadn't died of dysentery when he was 34 or whatever it was, and left an infant insane kid.
Don't be drinking the water.
Well, we'll forget about that. But I want to mention one directorial touch that I really liked in the first act, and I think it's part and parcel of what she was doing that ultimately didn't work for me. But the Harfleur scene, where the siege of Harfleur, which is usually Henry outside the walls with his army besieging Harfleur, telling them to surrender, and eventually they do. And it is one of the things that's nuanced about the play, because although Henry is sometimes in the play shown to be a very kind and benevolent monarch, as well as a great warrior, in this particular scene, some of the stuff that he threatens to do to the citizens of Harfleur is pretty horrifying. He basically demands their surrender and says, if you don't surrender, look out, because I'm going to let my soldiers rape all of your women. And we're going to take your babies and put them on pikes and hang them on your wall. So, I mean, it's some fucked up shit. But in this production, and I loved this.
I did.
It wasn't like an... Obviously, they didn't have the manpower to do this anyway. But the choice was, it was like an interrogation.
Yeah.
And Henry was like, you know, like a KGB agent interviewing / torturing the guy from Harfleur, the mayor of Harfleur, and it was really, it was chilling.
It was.
And it was so well played. Like, the moment he offered, he just gestured the guy to sit down, and the guy didn't sit down,
and then he
just
pointed at it. I loved that.
He did that so well.
And the thing about that point, I loved it, was that it was a gesture and it turned into a point.
It's like, sit down, motherfucker.
It was insinuous, it was beautiful.
And that's why we were so with it in the first act.
Yeah.
Because I want to say about, you know, the work of Holly Race Ruffin, if we are pronouncing her name correctly.
And forgive us if we're not,
right.
Holly.
I actually thought there was extreme talent in the direction. I just felt like it didn't ultimately make sense.
And then, but the thing that really killed it for me was the end, right? So it ends up with that great scene with Princess Catherine of France, right?
Which is a comedy scene.
It's a comedy scene. She doesn't speak any English. He wants to marry her. You know, Henry wants to marry her. All of this kind of stuff.
Well, and it's obviously an arranged marriage.
It's an arranged, of course.
So he's trying to be, you know, to break the ice with her.
And he's, you know, he's not being an asshole, right?
No,
for the most part, he's trying to be a good guy.
Although, I mean, he's not being an asshole unless you consider that he's just basically conquered her country and demanded her hand in marriage.
Yeah, but yes, but that, I mean, how many millions of times has that happened? You know, anyway, she's the Princess of France. So as I said to you last night, she's basically a commodity.
Right.
Right? They can do whatever they want with her. But that wasn't the problem, even though that scene wasn't particularly funny. The problem for me was that after that scene, they had a scene where it was modern day and there was like a government employee basically asking her the necessary questions for her to receive her citizenship.
Her UK citizenship.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and they actually followed the last scene of the play with a scene from earlier in the play that I thought she had cut entirely. The scene that we have often mentioned between Alice, the lady-in-waiting, and Catherine.
Yes.
With the English lesson from earlier in the play that ends with the famous fuck the cunt.
That's right.
Joke.
That's right.
Foutez le con, which we've talked about on other episodes.
Although she did call her mama.
Well, they changed it.
They made Alice
the Queen of France.
Yes, which is weird.
Which is also annoying.
Yes.
But they shoehorned that English lesson scene onto the end of the play, by the end of it, she was reciting like French and English, like she was trying to learn it in a very upset way.
She
needed to learn it to
nose,
be it to
elbow, all
right.
of that stuff.
But she was doing it because she had to learn it to cram it for her immigration exam.
Yeah, that I'm sorry, you lost me on that.
Yeah,
because what was the point? What are you trying to prove?
Well,
and why? I don't think that any purpose you had to your direction needs to add a scene that doesn't exist that's modern day. What are you saying? Is it a Brexit
that's
thing?
That was my take on it, was that it was a Brexit criticism, because it seemed like they turned Catherine into some kind of immigrant, like applying for UK status.
Yeah.
And it seemed like, you know, very, I don't know.
Right. So here's the difference, right? Like, there were so many things that were modernized, sort of, in As You Like It and brought up to date with such a beautiful, easy hand that everything worked. But this did not.
Well, the As You Like It was, I mean, it didn't feel like it was even... There was an attempt to make it modern. It was just in no time, you know. I mean,
but it was woke. I mean, woke. I hate the name woke. I hate the.
It wasn't. You know, I wouldn't. I mean, yeah, woke is.
It was inclusive.
It was inclusive. Well, that's what we were saying about it, right? I mean, it was progressive in all the best ways. It didn't call any attention or try to make any kind of political statement. It just was.
That's right.
And but this production was clear and not, well, I say clearly, but it was unclearly trying to make some kind of political statement that I was frankly not 100% sure what it was, but I was annoyed.
Yeah. Yeah. It was coitus interruptus for me. Like, it started off really well and then.
Yeah. And yet I was never bored.
I was never bored.
You know, it was,
and I thought the text was very clear. I thought all of the actors did a great job, and they clearly knew what they were saying.
It was
the direction that I had a problem with.
Well, me too. And yet, I will say this: I would rather see an interestingly directed play that doesn't really end up working than just a boring, nothingly directed play.
Totally, totally. And she's obviously a very skilled director.
Yeah, and
just didn't necessarily agree with how her take.
Yeah, I didn't ultimately either. Although there, like we've said, along the way there were some fantastic shit, and you know, I enjoyed it. It just, you know, I guess noble failure.
Agreed. But I would, but I did think that the cast was great, and I would love to see Oliver John Stone in something else.
Who, oh, yes. Who played Henry. Yeah, I think keep your eye on that guy, because he was excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
And so was everyone else. You know, I mean, literally everybody
else. I loved the guy that played Flewellyn, Joshua Griffin. Mm-hmm. I thought he was terrific.
Well, there wasn't one person that I didn't really like, but Oliver John Stone would... obviously had the most opportunity, and everything of it.
Of course.
And
so physical, Helena Lindberg, like such an interesting physical performance.
Yeah, yeah. And to your point also, the fights were terrific, which is not always the case.
So good for you, Kate Waters.
Yeah. And really, kudos to everybody, including the director. I was very impressed. It didn't end up working 100% for me.
I will say it's better than 90%. At least 90% of the Shakespeare that I've seen. So.
Well, you know, so often, unfortunately. Well, and listen, we're on a roll.
We are on a roll. Tonight we're seeing, we mentioned this to you guys, that Titus Andronicus, that is all female, where they change the word Moor to Negro. Mm-hmm. So we will...
In order to make it more clear that it's a racist play. Well, you know what? Yeah. The next time we record, we will have seen it.
That's right. And we will tell you guys all about it.
Yeah, that Henry V. Well, you know, I'm not going to give anything away because our listeners will find out on the next episode, but I certainly like that better than the other one we saw. So,
well, listen, for my money, it was worth it. It's such an experience to visit Shakespeare's Globe. I'm telling you, I've been there many times now. Now I've been to the Wanamaker, and although you're not guaranteed the greatest show ever. You always take your chances wherever you go.
Of course.
But it is always, always an amazing experience just to be inside those theaters.
That's right. So please visit our website at www.thebardcastudick.com. Please become a subscriber of ours on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel.
That's right. And of course, you can become a subscriber of the pod on our website at www.thebardcastudick.com. You will support us and you will receive interesting swag if you support us.
That's right. You can do that on patreon.com, or if you want to do a one-time donation, as we are a 501c3, 100% tax deductible, you can do that through PayPal.
And of course, you can visit our podcast charities, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and the Actors Fund.
That's right. And remember,
it's Shakespeare! You dick!
That was terrible.
The preceding podcast was a production of Country Matters Incorporated, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.